Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the voter suppression activities of Republican governors and legislatures that the Department of Justice is finally pushing back against. Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, joins us to discuss efforts underway to re-enfranchise 5 million eligible voters who have been denied their vote by new Republican laws intended to prevent likely Democratic voters from going to the polls in November. Then we will go to Europe to discuss an emergency meeting of the G7 finance ministers taking place on Tuesday to stop a run on the Spanish banks, which has heightened global concerns about Eurozone debt in the already strained 17-nation European currency arrangement. Amy Verdun, the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in Canada and co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies, joins us to assess whether this latest crisis meeting will finally address the two-year-long ongoing crisis. Then finally, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges joins us to discuss his latest book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. This graphic novel is a searing account of the travels of Hedges and cartoonist Joe Sacco through America's sacrifice zones, where our poorest, most exploited citizens are victims of the unchecked depredations of big business in a contemporary oligarchic system of masters and serfs. And joining us now is Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, where she founded and directed the center's Voting Rights and Election Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. She's authored a number of nationally recognized publications and articles on voting rights and election reform, litigated groundbreaking voting rights lawsuits, testified before both houses of Congress in a variety of state legislatures, and provided policy and legislative drafting assistance to federal and state legislators with administrators across the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Weiser.
Thank you for having me.
And where do we stand in terms of your center, the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law? Initially, some time back, said that about 5 million people were being scrubbed off the election list, eligible voters who were being denied the vote in this election cycle. It looks finally as though the Justice Department has acted. There's been some questions about their torpor there, but now they seem to be acting. But there's also some defiance being shown. Let's start with Florida, with Governor Rick Scott defying the federal warning to stop purging people. Where does that stand?
Well, Florida is one of the states that not only have passed restrictive voting laws, but has now taken a very radical step in trying to do a massive purge of the voter rolls in a short period of time right before an election. It has created lists of tens of thousands of people and claimed that they are people who should be removed from the voter rolls. Preliminary investigations are suggesting that a huge number of those people are, in fact, eligible Florida citizens and should still stay on the voter rolls. The Department of Justice stepped in and said, hey, wait a second, you can't do this in Florida. In Florida, you need to actually get federal approval before you move forward with a new kind of purge process like this. Florida is one of the states that are covered by the Federal Voting Rights Act and need federal approval. The Department of Justice also said that this purge, even if you got federal approval, would violate the federal motor voter law, because that law actually protects against these kind of last-minute efforts to clean up the voter roll. Congress recognized that people make lots of mistakes in the period right before the elections, and if you want to do a massive purge of the voter rolls, you need to do it a little bit earlier when there's enough time to get it right. So that is what the Department of Justice did. Governor Scott came back and said, you know, we're not stopping this. But there's good news for Florida. The supervisors of elections, the people who are actually at the front lines and who would actually be the ones who would be removing the names from the voter rolls, said, you know, we're not moving forward right now with this purge. We're not actually going to delete these names from the voter rolls. We're listening to what the Department of Justice said. They are actually pushing back. So we're seeing a really unusual battle in the state between the chief executive and the those who actually run the elections day to day. It's a really unusual and remarkable set of events.
And what's happening in Alabama, where the Alabama is challenging the Department of Justice over voting rights law?
You know, there's actually a whole bunch of states who, and Alabama was the first, to file lawsuits saying, You know, we don't like the Voting Rights Act. This was the premier civil rights law, the most successful piece of civil rights legislation in our nation's history. It's been largely credited with ushering in an era of much greater political equality on the basis of race in our country. This is the law that Martin Luther King and others like John Lewis marched for, and was just recently reauthorized by overwhelming bipartisan majorities of Congress and signed into law by George W. Bush back in 2006. And just over the past 2 years, we've seen a number of states saying, we don't want this law, we think the court should strike it down. So it's been a remarkable turnaround, and Shelby County, Alabama, one of the jurisdictions that are covered by the law, its case was the first one decided by a federal court. It was a 3-judge panel out of D.C., and that court roundly rejected the challenge. It said this is actually good law. Congress has no doubt has the power to enact this law. Congress has the power under the Constitution to actually protect against race discrimination in voting, and this is a reasonable attempt to do so, and to target the places where there's been a history, a real documented and ongoing history of racial discrimination in voting.
Again, I'm speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, where she founded and directed the center's Voting Rights and Election Project. And across the country, of course, in various states where we've had, in 2010, Republican governors took over and Republicans captured the legislatures, there's been a pattern of laws that have been enacted, and much of it has been apparently drafted by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, who have drafted these model laws. Of course, they got a lot of publicity in Florida over the shooting of Trayvon Martin at the Stand Your Ground law. But these voter suppression or these new draconian rules that have come in are also part of ALEC, along with privatization of education that's taken place in Louisiana. So on many, many fronts, it seems that ALEC and the Republicans are active. What can the Democrats do, though? One would think that moral suasion would be something in a democracy that it's just unacceptable to disenfranchise people. But I guess that's not working. Is there anything else that can work here in ahead of this election to get these 5 million people back on the rolls?
Actually, the moral suasion and the pushback is actually starting to bear fruit. Where round one went to the vote suppressors, and we did see the most significant wave of laws cutting back on voting, making it harder for eligible American citizens to vote than we've seen in decades since the Jim Crow era. 23 laws and 2 executive actions in 18 states. And that's a huge wave over the past 2 years. But we are now seeing a very successful pushback. Just on Thursday evening, for example, a federal court just struck down Florida's attempt to hobble voter registration drives with severe and onerous regulations that may essentially shut down voter registration drives across the state, caused the League of Women Voters, for example, to impose a statewide moratorium on voter registration efforts that it's been conducting for more than 70 years. And a federal court said it blocked that. It said this violates the Constitution. This violates our most cherished rights to speak and associate and promote voting among our fellow citizens. And so that's one significant victory. But in fact, every single court to have looked at any of these laws in this wave of restrictive laws this year has found them lacking. This is not a legitimate wave of laws to regulate the voting process. You know, this is vote suppression, and the courts are pushing back. And these courts are at the federal level, at the state level, Republican appointees, Democratic appointees. It's a real across-the-board pushback in the courts and in the Department of Justice. And we've even seen voters push back in some states, and states like Maine and Ohio that have a citizen initiative process. Voters have actually pushed back against these laws that are restricting voting and overturned them. So we're actually seeing round two going to voters. The voters are really gaining ground, and hopefully by the time the election rolls around, far fewer of these restrictions will be in place, and voters will actually be able to participate free from these serious and unnecessary burdens.
Well, of course, the U.S., Wendy White, is somewhat unique amongst the democracies of having so many impediments, particularly registration and different rules in every state. And this has discouraged a lot of people, and the young in particular don't seem to be difficult to motivate in the first place to vote. And if it's not made easy, they tend not to vote, and that's why Motor Voter and these other efforts to make it simple and easy, and in Maine they had same-day registration and voting. I understand that that's how they've the voter suppressors have been at work in this country, is to, you know, make the registration process less easy. I mean, frankly, I don't even understand why it's there in the first place, having seen elections in other democracies, but that's, I guess, another discussion.
Yeah, well, it is true that a significant portion of these new restrictions are making voter registration harder. And the more hoops you put in front of people, the less likely they are to vote and participate. And that's been true for decades. And in fact, historically, any time that there's been a real pushback against voting rights and attempt to suppress votes, it's always started with a more onerous voter registration regulations. And so that's why we really need to focus on actually improving our voter registration system. And this is the 21st century. We should not be operating with a paper-based system that gives people the discretion to do what Florida just attempted to do, to sort of selectively knock people off the voter rolls, that actually create all these crazy hurdles and lead to rolls that are riddled with errors. I mean, Pew Center in the States found that the voter rolls are actually dramatically incomplete. They did a recent study, they found that more than a quarter of eligible Americans are not on the voter rolls, and that even those people that are on the voter rolls, there are mistakes on their records. 1 in 8 records have serious errors in them. They're just completely inaccurate, and that's just not the kind of system we should have for the 21st century. This is actually an easily solvable problem. We could just modernize our voter registration system, and that's actually a real solution that everyone can get behind. And to get past these voting wars, it would reduce the opportunity for fraud. It would make our voter rolls more complete and accurate. It would really solve all the problems. And if we were really serious about improving our systems instead of excluding voters, that's what we'd be focused on.
Well, interesting enough, next door in Mexico, they have a universal voter ID that seems to work very well. And, we've always sort of considered many of the nations to the south to be conducting kind of banana republic democracies. But it's a little ironic, is it not, that Mexico's system is a lot more foolproof, tamper-proof, easy and user-friendly than ours.
Many countries actually have voter registration systems that work a whole lot better than ours. And many countries also work a whole lot better than the United States at actually getting IDs to all eligible citizens. I mean, that's a real problem here, is that we've been seeing a wave of voter identification laws that aren't reasonable voter ID laws that ask people for the kinds of IDs that they do have. They're very restrictive laws that limit the forms of acceptable IDs to IDs that 10% of the population just don't have. And they cherry pick. They say, we will accept a concealed handgun license, but we won't accept your student ID, even if it's state issued. So these are, we are seeing laws that, appear to be designed to exclude at least certain groups of voters, and there aren't real reasonable attempts to include everybody. And that's something that we don't see in other countries as much. And, in part because the election administration is, in other countries, freed from partisan influence in many other places.
So in terms of what can be done, though, to sort of smoke out those people who, I understand some of the voting suppressors use arguments like fraud, they're preventing fraud when there's statistically very little evidence of fraud. Is there a more robust way to have a kind of national referendum on people that really don't want Americans to vote and those that do? You would think it would kind of cross party lines. It would be sort of a mom and apple pie issue. But I'm just trying to figure a way here to, since moral suasion doesn't work, is there another mechanism that you've thought about? I mean, I know you work on this issue and you're fighting all these tiny little battles all the time, aren't you?
It is true, but I think this year it reached a threshold where people are getting up and taking notice and saying this is just too much. this is something fishy is going on here, and this is not legitimate. I think, you know, when it was a more scattershot effort, you know, it didn't reach people's radar screens in the same way. But now that it's, you know, been such a concerted effort and pushback against voters, and it's been making it harder for people to vote across the country, I think that, you know, there's a real opportunity, a moment for people to say, hey, you know, hey, wait a second, this isn't what American democracy is about. This is not what's supposed to happen. We're supposed to have fair rules of the game where everybody who's eligible gets to participate, and you don't win by knocking out your opponent's voters. You win by persuading them to vote for you. And so I do think that there's a real opportunity to push back. I also think that a lot of these laws actually violate fundamental American principles that are already embodied in federal law and in the U.S. Constitution and in our state constitutions, and that's why we're seeing the courts push back as well, saying, hey, wait a second, we already protect against this. This isn't something that also, you know, you can't really vote on who else gets to participate. You know, everybody who's an eligible citizen gets to participate, whether you like it or not. That is a fundamental principle of American democracy, and that's embodied in our Constitution.
And even though our courts have moved considerably to the right, and particularly the Supreme Court, there's still enough fairness and objectivity in the legal system to render the right judgments?
You know, we certainly haven't lost all faith in the courts. In fact, the courts have been pushing back against these laws. You know, it remains to be seen how it's going to ultimately end up, but we have seen real pushback across the country from all sorts of courts. You know, the First Amendment, the right to vote, these are fundamental American constitutional principles. And I think it would be very hard-pressed a court to actually find that they don't matter and that they don't carry weight.
So just in closing, Wendy Weiser, there's a couple of key elections, of course, tomorrow, both here in California and in Wisconsin with a recall election. I understand that Department of Justice is actually sending monitors down there. So we've been having a conversation about trying to re-enfranchise people who've been systematically disenfranchised, who are eligible to vote in the general election and the primary elections. But we're not free from what happens after your vote, which is, you know, it's the old adage of Joseph Stalin's, it doesn't matter who votes, but who counts the vote. What do you know about why the Justice Department is sending a team down to check on this recall vote in Wisconsin?
You know, the Department of Justice is statutorily both authorized and obligated to send monitors across the country to places where, to jurisdictions where they think that there's a risk of violations of the, you know, voter rights under the Federal Voting Rights Act and under other civil rights laws. And so they are sending monitors, and they're authorized to look and see if their voters are going to be intimidated, if they're going to be improperly discriminated against the polls. And so that's what they're there to do. And that's something that they actually routinely do. They do this in a variety of elections. They don't have enough staff to cover every single election, but they do notify the public when they go and cover an election. And it adds an extra layer of protection on the ground and against efforts to intimidate and otherwise knock out unfairly voters.
So that's not to suggest that, because we know from the polling that it's going to be a very tight race, the recall race in Wisconsin, it's not to suggest that the vote count won't be accurate and transparent.
They are not there to monitor the vote count. They are there to monitor the polls and make sure that the voters' civil rights are not being interfered with. The counting of the votes is not something that they have anything to do with. The Department of Justice is not involved in that at all. That's a state function. We haven't heard any reason to worry that there's going to be any impropriety in the vote count in Wisconsin.
Well,
and
I think
they're not there to monitor the vote count. They're there to monitor the polls and make sure that voters are fairly treated under federal law.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Wendy Weiser.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directed the center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. She's authored a number of nationally recognized publications and articles on voting rights and election reform, litigated groundbreaking voting rights lawsuits, testified before both houses of Congress and in a variety of state legislatures, and provided policy and legislative legislative drafting assistance to federal and state legislators and administrators across the country. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Europe to talk about the G7 finance ministers' emergency meeting. All that dying and dust, blowing up your hopes, flamboyant obstacles, oh, deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise of the loss, yeah, 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 hey, here we stand, slave to networks, master plans, swags the brand, open a can, chains off still, yeah, I never ran, but do you think you are? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Amy Verdun, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Responses to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She is also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Verdun.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And you're in Holland now on your way to Brussels. And I believe tomorrow there'll be a crisis meeting of the financial chiefs of the Group of Seven, which are Canada, United States, Japan, Britain, Germany, France, and Italy. And the Canadian finance minister, Jim Flaherty, has already suggested that this is an emergency effort to sort of finally get something done here in terms of this two-year-long crisis that the Germans seem incapable of getting their hands around. Already, Germany has said, because there's concern about the run on the banks in Spain, Germany's already said, well, it's up to Spain to ask for money, not for the rest of you. So can you explain what's happening with the German truculence here?
Yes, well, it's a very difficult situation. The European Union, as you know, is governed by member states who make decisions collectively. And the situation in the euro area over the past 2 years has brought to a height that we are clearly seeing a difficulty in governing the European Union. You point to Germany, and I think it's indeed true to say that the Germans are particularly concerned with the situation, and they also sit on the biggest wallet, so to say. So anything that has to be paid, most of it does come from Germany. The Germans have been concerned since the very first day that the single currency was created that there could be a moment where some of the participants in the single currency wouldn't be sufficiently financially solvent to look after their own fiscal house. And they had put rules in place in order to make sure that that would not happen. Their worries had been about countries in the south of Europe, so Italy, Spain, Greece, Portugal. And what we see in this period is that it has indeed been those countries that have been at the heart of the fiscal crisis in the European Union. So the Germans have been stressing that in order for money to be moved from the collection of European member states to countries that are in financial need, that stringent rules would have to be adhered to. So what we see now is negotiations about under what circumstances could deepening integration take place.
But in the meantime, there appears to be a run on the Spanish banks. They're all but insolvent. And as soon as weak euro states, their people start cashing in Spanish and Greek euros for German euros or switching to the pound, doesn't that have an alarming kind of echo of what happened in the 1920s?
It is indeed very worrying. One of the problems that we see coming up now with the euro area is that it is indeed very easy to move from, as you said, Spanish euros to German euros. As you know, they are exactly the same euros. They are like United States dollars are the same wherever you are in the world. So if a person in Spain, an investor or a consumer, is worried about the solvency of Spanish banks,
in the modern time, it's extremely easy for that money just to move to another area where there are euros. So you don't even have to convert them into another currency. You just park them at another bank.
And that's happening. That's happening, right?
Pardon me?
That's happening on a growing scale. My understanding is that
that is indeed happening on the growing scale. And so one of the responses the European leaders are talking about today, or have been speaking about today in all secrecy, but it's leaked to the news here as I was watching the evening news here in the Netherlands, is that they're talking about what they call a banking union. A banking union would be a union in which the European Union member states guarantee the savings of people who have savings accounts or current accounts in any of the banks of the European euro area, most likely it's the euro area, so that people wouldn't have the incentive to move to another bank in the eurozone because they're worried about a run on the banks.
So again, though, Amy Verdun, who is the chair of the political science department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, and she's also the co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies, and we're talking to Amy in the Netherlands. Again, though, Robert Zoellick, the head of the IMF, has been warning Germany to deal with this. And obviously, we have a situation here where it's all sort of on Angela Merkel's shoulders, in effect, to make some kind of bold step that will finally, once and for all, stop this endless crisis. And the real question is she capable of being a statesman? Clearly she's a very good politician in terms of coalition governance, but this is a moment that at least people on the outside are saying, and I imagine, you know, the subtext here in the United States is, if the euro goes under, it's going to affect our elections here and the fate of the re-election of Obama. So there's a great deal of concern on this side that Merkel has yet to get her act together. And we're asking her to be more of a statesman and less of a politician. What's your understanding of the situation?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting period. As I mentioned when I started off, Germany has been holding the key to this all along. But it's not, I wouldn't say it's totally fair to say that it's Germany's fault or Germany's concern not to be able to solve this, because what the Germans will need to do is build a coalition with the other EU member states and agree to the conditions under which they're willing to help. So I mentioned a moment ago about the banking union. That would be to guarantee the savings and checking account, the current account of all the savers in the various euro member states. But clearly a guarantee means that somebody's going to ultimately be responsible for backing that up. A year and a half ago, Ireland backed up the savings of the Irish citizens and who held money in Ireland. Lots of UK people came over to Ireland and parked their money there, and at some point the Irish government wasn't able to sort of secure it with the amount of money that they needed to secure that. So it's not a matter of only being a good statesman. It's also having the political will, not just from one leader, but also its population and the wider EU member state populations to back that up with rules and common governance.
Well, George Soros, who of course has made a considerable amount of money out of trading currencies, etc., and one could argue whether or not that's a particularly useful activity. But he has been concerned for some time that the inability of the European leaders to deal with this crisis. He's talking about a new kind of German empire, if you will, in Northern Europe, and a kind of division between North and South. To some extent, the debate has already been somewhat racialized, hasn't it? My understanding is that most Germans consider that the Greeks and the Italians and the Spanish don't work as hard, don't pay taxes, and it's their problem, and why should we bail them out? And that is, again, what my understanding of the political problem is here, that Merkel has a tough time persuading her very truculent citizens that they should pony up any more money.
Yes, that has indeed been the problem. I'm not sure that all German citizens are quite so skeptical. There has been quite a bit of populist rhetoric going back and forth. Earlier in the year, we heard people in Germany say that, you know, the Greeks were lazy and so on. And very quickly, a report came out showing that the Germans retire earlier than the Greeks, and they have more holidays than the Greeks. So there's been a lot of political rhetoric that's been bounced back and forth. But I think what the Germans, maybe more than others in the European Union, need to come to terms with is the question of whether at this intersection of history one wants to move forward or move back. The current status quo is not a status quo. It won't be maintainable for very much longer. And it occurs to me and to quite a number of observers that Europe will need to now either integrate more deeply or run the risk of there being a breakup of some kind. Now, a breakup is not attractive to anybody. I haven't heard any advocates saying that that would be something that anybody would want particularly. It's more that the difficulty of agreeing to deeper union is that one is having to be willing to pay the price for that. So in normal language, in the United States or Canada, there is a transfer of the states or the provinces that aren't doing so well, and that transfer comes in a form of funds from the federal level to those states in the interest of having a strong union. And the European Union is now embarking on that very exercise, like how much are they willing to keep this together, coughing up some of the resources, but then also having to make rules. In the United States, states can't run a deficit. They're supposed to be in balanced budgets. The European Union in December agreed to do something very similar. They've asked all the member states of the European Union, except for the United Kingdom and Czech Republic, who weren't willing to participate. But all the others have signed a treaty in which they are going to put a balanced budget arrangement in their constitution. So they've made these steps, but we're not exactly completely there, and that's why we have the difficulties at the current time.
And again, I'm speaking with Amy Verdun, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She's in Holland as we speak, on the way to Brussels. And just today, the finance chiefs of the group of seven nations, including the United States, Canada, Japan, Britain, Germany, France, and Italy, have said that they're going to hold talks on the Eurozone debt crisis on Tuesday. And the Canadian Finance Minister Jim Flaherty has gone public and saying that the real concern right now is Europe, of course, the weakness of some of the banks in Europe, the fact that they're undercapitalized, the fact that other European countries in the Eurozone have not taken sufficient action yet to address those issues of undercapitalization of banks and building an adequate firewall, of course, referring to Spain. Are you confident that there will be sufficient action in terms of a firewall? That's, again, we've had this discussion for 2 years now.
Yes, I think there is still the political will amongst the leaders to move ahead. It's just a very difficult constellation of actors with not only Germany, as we've discussed, but also a new French president who has been emphasizing the need for growth. He's been having a difficulty with the notion of austerity, which has been central to the idea of spending more money on these countries. It also meant making sure that they are cutting back on excessive expenses. So there's been a change over there that's made for some setbacks in collective European governance. And the other part that's making a lot of the leaders very concerned is that the Greek government, the Greek electorate is going to go to the elections on the 17th of June. And if a strong anti-austerity political party constellation will be voted into power there, there's also concerns about what that might mean. So the temperature is up, if you like, and this is the heat is on for the coming 2 weeks to sort of come to a good resolution.
So do you think there will be a resolution before the next G20 summit, which is in Mexico? I mean, again, there's the feeling that you can't, surely we can't keep kicking the can down the road, can we?
Yes, I mean, it's very difficult from the as an outsider to see exactly how much more it will take for them to negotiate a deal. But I know they've been working behind the scenes on picking up an arrangement that would try to solve this matters, as I mentioned, the banking union. And maybe they're even talking once again about euro bonds, which is an arrangement whereby there wouldn't be bonds issued in nation states, but in the euro area. So like a treasury bond, but then a treasury bill, but then for the euro area, that might also be a way to offset some of the problems that Spain and Italy and Greece have had in trying to finance their sovereign debt. But again, those are things that are being discussed, and in order to make those decisions, other governance arrangements have to be made, and they're complicated and they take time. It's very unfortunate that way.
Well, my understanding is that in their last meeting between Hollande and Merkel, Hollande did want, he was pushing for the Eurobonds, and but the German finance minister shot it down. So again, you see, you know, I'm certainly not beating up on the Germans, but again, it always feels like at the end of the day, they're the ones that hold the cards.
Well, I agree. I think the Germans now are the strongest player in the European Union context. So they have an ultimate say, and they can also stop things if they're not yet convinced that the deal is sufficiently in line with what they feel is appropriate. Angela Merkel did say, and it was reported in the Financial Times last week, that she would be willing to consider Eurobonds provided it comes together with a treaty change and some arrangements that nation states would have to agree to keep their budgetary deficit and public debt under control to a larger extent, accept supervision from European institutions, the European Commission on sort of public finance in nation states. So it's kind of a tit for tat, right? If one wants to have German money guarantee the expenditures of some of these nation states, then it may require that they accept some supervision from others on their day-to-day budgetary and fiscal matters. And I think that's the trade-off.
So what's your sense then, being in Europe, Amy Verdun, about, you mentioned the Greek elections coming up and the likelihood that they would vote in an anti-austerity government, who've already laid down their marker saying that they're going to repudiate all of the previous deals. So that's even got officials like the Chinese are concerned of Greece defaulting from the euro. Some people have actually argued that another way out of this would be for the Germans to withdraw from the euro. Of course, that's not politically likely, right?
No, I don't think at all. In fact, I don't even think the Greeks are going to necessarily vote for parties that are being very anti-austerity. I think in the last elections, when they voted for parties that weren't going to support these plans, it was very much a vote of severe discontent, of frustration, of irritation of the period that had gone before them. Since that election has taken place, they have not been able to form a government, and therefore they're going back to the polls. And in the last couple of weeks, it's been made very clear that one of the results of a vote for sort of an anti-establishment party or parties that are against austerity measures and the agreements made by the European Union with Greece, which at the time included both the government and the opposition parties, if they're not willing to step forward with that, it could possibly mean a breakup of the euro area, that is, an exit by Greece. And if you look at the opinion polls, it's still 70-80% of the people still want to stay in the euro. So I really don't know whether the Greek citizens are going to vote for, you know, anti-establishment or sort of against austerity measures. It's hard for me to say that at this time. So we will just have to see what the Greeks do. The only concern simply is that one doesn't know this. And
sure.
If the outcome is the same, then there would be a concern about what that might mean for the period after 17th of June.
Well, I think just in closing, Amy Verdun, you're touching on what's really at issue here, surely, and that is confidence. And it's somewhat emotional quotient, isn't it? I mean, there's a kind of a wild card here in this. And that's why apparently a lot of these foreign ministers, these finance ministers, including Canada's finance minister, are sounding the alarm, because even though there hasn't really been a full-scale run on the banks in Spain, there could be. And, irrationality can take over, can't it, at any moment. That's where we stand. They're talking about a firewall. They're talking about, stopping the bleeding, if you will. But there's also the very real possibility of a wild card erupting, surely. Particularly,
absolutely. You know. This is exactly the reason why the G7 is getting involved, and it's not merely a matter of the euro area leaders. It is something that is quite different from what would have been the case, during the Depression in the 1920s and 1930s. Because at that time, it wasn't that easy to press on your computer a button so that your money just moved from here to there. And of course, that is a different circumstance from what would have been the case years ago. And because everybody is so connected and globalization has taken on forms that everybody can talk to everybody in the speed of lightning, There are dynamics that are beyond the reason and rationale of what could be possible that could just suddenly spark a panic. So I think that trust matter is indeed a key to why some of these issues are quite a bit more worrying than simply the economic fundamentals.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Holland. Amy Verdun.
Thanks very much, Ian, for inviting me to the program.
Again, I've been speaking with Amy Verdun, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Response to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. And she's also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, Chris Hedges.
They want you lost in your own fear. No compass, find your way out. A troglodyte, a derelict barn campaign. Pretend the filthy rich, the beggar's ditch, God.
We're all presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops, and waiting, we're the workers of the world. There is the elite and the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all it's worth? Reaching out to get a kind of perfection. Let's try and keep as much emotion.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Chris Hedges, who's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002, he was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, and Death of the Liberal Class. His latest book just out is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Ian.
And Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which is illustrated by Joe Sacco. This book is a kind of a warning of a coming, a kind of an American dystopia. How, in fact, you know, going beyond the obvious questions of are we still a democracy? Have we become an oligarchy? And are we indeed heading into a kind of plantation economy? Some of the places that you covered, for example, in Welsh West Virginia, Days of Devastation, my understanding is that wasn't that where they filmed that dystopian teenage film that came out? What was it called? The Hunters or the...
I didn't even hear that. I don't know.
Anyway, I don't mean to confuse you, but in other words, there's a combination of in the popular culture, a sense of dystopia, and you've really experienced it and documented the real dystopia.
Well, you know, there are always sacrifice zones, these areas that are exploited without any kind of regulation or protection, such as the coal fields of southern West Virginia, these dead enclaves in inner cities like Camden. Camden is a chapter which per capita is the poorest city in the United States. It produces virtually nothing. It was at one point a manufacturing center. And a point of the book, although it is a heavily reported book, is that these sacrifice zones are just spreading outwards now that there is no impediment at all to corporate capitalism. They are in the process rapidly reconfiguring the country into a form of neo-feudalism. And we went to the epicenters where it started to give people a glimpse of what awaits them if this corporate coup d'etat is not reversed. Karl Marx was right in that sense. Unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force. It commodifies everything. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it then exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And we tried to do that by telling the stories of the first victims, the people who are the precursors to what awaits the rest of us. And this book is more than illustrated by Sacco. There's 50 pages of drawings, but a lot of them are, as you know, are comic panels. So it will actually, and often the most poignant personal narratives flip into panels that not only have their quotes, but illustrate their suffering, their lives, and what they've endured. And I think it gives the book a kind of punch.
And the chapters in the book are Days of Theft, Pine Ridge in South Dakota, Days of Siege, Camden, New Jersey, Days of Devastation, Welsh, West Virginia, Days of Slavery, Immokalee, Florida, and Days of Revolt, Liberty Square, New York. Again, the brand new book by Chris Hedges, illustrated by Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. I was trying to think of the name of the movie. It was called The Hunger Games, and it was based on a huge bestseller and it became one of the biggest hits, movie hits of the year. And neither you or I have seen it, Chris, but the point about it is that that somehow out there in the zeitgeist, and particularly amongst the young, we're talking about this appeal to the 20-year-olds and younger, this sense of decay, of a kind of looming dystopia here in the United States, and and the destruction of the American dream, which of course is being marketed now by the two politicians that are running. And I find it absolutely astounding that after what happened on Wall Street in 2008, that the 1% could have the hubris to run a candidate who is the poster boy of the 1%. And you know, I think Romney's got a very good chance of being elected.
Well, as you may know, I think they both serve the interests of the 1%, pretty assiduously, especially this announcement now that in terms of expanding drilling in the Arctic wildlife refuge, I think the problem is that power lies now, and this was the brilliance of Occupy Wall Street, not in Washington. These people are corporate employees, but on Wall Street itself. And you walk into these sacrifice zones, and you see what happens to human beings when you are blowing the top 400 feet off of mountains, the violence that does to communities, to families, to personal dignity, to self-esteem, the substance abuse, the breakdown in relations, both within the family, within the community, the despair, the high suicide rates. I mean, you go to Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the average life expectancy of a male is 48 years old. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. By the time you get to Immokalee, Florida, our produce fields, as Bernie Sanders has pointed out, in the race to the bottom, Immokalee is the bottom, you actually replicate slavery, i.e. people are held against their will, forced to work without wages. It is just a staggering window into what corporations that have no impediments will do to human beings. And if we don't wake up, then we are going to replicate the power structure of George Orwell's 1984, where you have a tiny inner party circle of 3-4%, an outer party circle of managers of about 12%, and the rest of us are going to be proles. That's where we're headed.
Well, I think, though, that given what's happening in Europe with Merkel basically unable to deal with the euro crisis, and it's likely to cascade over here, and given the elections in this country are ruled apparently by the basis of it's the economy, stupid. I would say that even if there's not much difference between the two candidates, that a President Romney would be the ultimate culmination of the corporatization of America. I mean, he is a corporate CEO, and he would run the country like a corporation. And
I think that in terms of policies, there's very little daylight between Romney and Obama. And you can take Obamacare. Obamacare was formulated by the Heritage Foundation, first put into practice in 2006 when Romney was governor of Massachusetts, and then adopted by the Obama administration after the pharmaceutical and insurance industries wrote in $447 billion in subsidies, the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, and then passed it. And I think that when we look at legislation, whether it is the prosecution of imperial wars, the failure to to register. Wall Street, Obama's record on civil liberties is actually worse than George Bush's, and I sued him and won, amazingly, for the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, which allows U.S. citizens to be arrested by the military and held without due process. I think we have to look at what they do and not what they say. In terms of human beings, you're right. I mean, Obama is a more palatable figure, but I think structurally we are headed, a kind of a corporate oligarchic feudalism, and I don't think either Obama or Romney are going to do much to stop it.
Well, you've done something to stop it, and tell us about what you did in terms of the case that you brought forward.
Well, this was, I sued Barack Obama and Leon Panetta. It made it to federal court, and the judge, Catherine Forrest, actually ruled in our favor. We have heard that the government intends to appeal it, but she ruled that that we were credible plaintiffs and that this was an unconstitutional law, and she issued a temporary injunction invalidating it. It was really a remarkable ruling. But I think that on so many levels, including the Espionage Act, which Obama has used six times to stop whistleblowers and leakers, we have seen this president, tighten the stranglehold that was begun by George Bush, and he hasn't even restored habeas corpus, the FISA Amendment Act. It's quite terrifying when we ignore the personal narratives of candidates, and I think that political philosophers like Sheldon Wolin or earlier Benjamin DeMott pointed all of this out, that the narratives of these candidates is irrelevant to where political and economic power lies, and it really lies out of their hands. It lies at this point in the hands of the corporate oligarchy, and if Obama doesn't dance to their tunes, he's finished. Romney, of course, dances to their tunes and always has, and that's why the end of the book is Days of Revolt, that the only credible chance that we have for a systematic change will come through mass protests and civil disobedience, and we all need to look up what's happening in Quebec with those students who pulled 250,000 people into the streets when they tried to pass laws which mirror the laws that Rahm Emanuel put in place in Chicago and that the corporate state is trying to cement to prevent legitimate dissent, to in essence criminalize legitimate dissent. It's all part of the same system. And unfortunately, there's only one way we're going to effectively change it, and it's not by voting.
Well, it feels like, I've been talking about the country being a plutonomy ruled by oligarchs now for some years, and people thought it was a kind of becoming a broken record. But then the 99% movement came along and put that front and center in the national consciousness. And I suppose if you take the analogy of the Alcoholics Anonymous, where the first thing you have to admit is that you're an alcoholic. And in this case, the first thing I think we have to admit is that we're no longer a democracy. Now we've got to take some extra steps. So where are we in terms of the steps towards doing what's actually in the preamble to the Constitution, that when a government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to overturn it and replace it?
Well, we have watched essentially the counter-revolution. That's what the state has unleashed by shutting down in coordination and a coordinated effort the 18 occupying camps and then sort of slowly picking off the rest. And it's not just external repression. We know that they have devoted tremendous resources to infiltrating these movements and trying to fragment, destroy them, splinter them. And it's certainly hurt the Occupy movement. But all of the issues that drove people into these encampments, the long-term unemployment, the student debt, the failure to address the bank repossessions and foreclosures, are still there and getting worse. And especially now as we begin to push through these austerity programs where the most basic services to those who are most distressed within our society are being cut or eliminated. It means this movement isn't going to go away. how will it reconfigure itself? How will it manifest itself? I don't know. No one knows. Even the people closest to these movements don't know. I've covered movements, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the Palestinian uprisings or intifada, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, and these movements have a kind of life, power, almost mystical force of their own. But I believe that they're still there, bubbling beneath the surface of the society, ready to erupt. And I think that the security and surveillance state agrees with me, which is why they are rapidly pushing through legal mechanisms by which they can carry out draconian forms of repression. You know, Joe and I spent months in these places because we wanted to put a human face on what's happening. It's not a book of rhetoric. It's not a book of theory. It's a book where the pain is palpable and real, and the cruelty and I think, you know, force of destruction that is embodied in the corporate state is quite literally made visible, not only in the writing, but in the illustrations and comic panels that Sacco has contributed to the book. And I think, you know, for that reason, deeply enriched the book. The people who live with this kind of misery in our society because of the corporate media have been rendered virtually invisible, and the goal was to make them visible as a kind of flashing red light, a warning for what's about to happen to the rest of us. And I think, you know, I'm a huge admirer of Joe Sacco, as I think anyone who knows his work is. It's a unique kind of project. We've not married those two forms of narrative journalism and graphic journalism, and I think it really works. You know, I mean, I spent 20 years as abroad as a foreign correspondent, and I can't tell you how many elections I covered in dictatorships, whether it was Syria or Pinochet's Chile, or Iran or anywhere else. And it is an effective way to siphon off energy into a really futile exercise, and I would argue that's where we are today. You know, I'll vote, but I'm not going to waste any emotional or intellectual energy on this campaign, on who said what. I will pull a lever. I won't vote for Obama, and I won't vote for Romney. At this point, it's a vote of defiance. That's either Green or Rocky Anderson or none of the above, and then get back out where we belong, which is in the street. Take a look at what's happening in Quebec. Once you can, they pulled 250,000 people.
Amazing.
Once we can begin to, on a steady basis, pull those kinds of numbers. And it's important that we remain nonviolent because the object, the power structure is so rotten and so corroded and so corrupt that the idea is to draw those forces, especially the foot soldiers, over to our side and create paralysis within those structures of power. And I think that's possible. I think that this corporate oligarchic criminal class has just overstepped their bounds. They've gone too far. And I think they're very vulnerable, and I think we see it in how frightened they became of the Occupy movement.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Chris Hedges.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Hedges as a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002 he was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, and Death of the Liberal Class. His latest book just out is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Christian Vasquez and Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.